Well, we've had a few weeks away, so let's just remind ourselves of what we really are looking at here in the book of Proverbs. We know that this part was written by Solomon, King Solomon, the son of David. And we know that when Solomon did become the king, he felt somewhat overwhelmed by the responsibility and the work ahead of him, that he was visited by God and asked, well, what would you ask of me? And he asked for wisdom. How on earth am I going to follow my father, King David? And we know that he was a mighty king, a very famous king, said of him in the Bible that he was a man after God's own heart, and he brought the nation of Israel into a prosperity that was, well, unthinkable before his reign. Solomon takes over and he asks for wisdom, and wisdom is given to him. If you've ever read through the book of Proverbs and then the next book, the book of Ecclesiastes, and then the Song of Solomon, you cannot be amazed by his understanding of multiple different areas of the world in which we live. Admittedly, he lived, well, near on 3,000 years ago. So if you were to try and talk to him about molecular science or, nuclear physics and things like that, he would have scratched his head and said, I ain't got one iota of a clue what you're talking about. But if you talk to him about life, if you talk to him about wisdom, if you talk to him about the family, if you talk to him about money, if you talk to him about politics, if you talk to him about all of these various different things that we find in the book of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and the Song of Solomon that he wrote, here is a man who really knew what he was talking about. Everyday wisdom for everybody, if you like. Now, he is writing for his sons who will be high-ranking civil servants. He is writing for those that are within the government, primarily in many ways. It is directed and they are addressed directly within the book. But it is not just for those who are in government. It is not just for leaders. It's not just for the aristocracy. It's for you and me, the common people here this evening. Everyday wisdom for everybody. The ability to live life skillfully, making good decisions. Now, who wants to put their hand up and say, I don't want to live skillfully and I want to make bad decisions all of my life? Nobody's going to put their hand up and say such a foolish thing. And if they do, they really are a fool. And if they carry on in such a way, they won't live for very long. To deal skillfully and successfully with the practical affairs of everyday life. Now, for the littlest ones amongst us, and we've not got many very little ones amongst us here this evening, it might just go shoom straight over their head. But as soon as you reach your teenage years and you enter into your 20s, these are the kinds of things you've got to grapple with. Living a godly life in an ungodly world, if you are a believer here this evening. Living in harmony with the created and moral order of the God who made all things. The skill, if you like, and the art of living godly in a godless age. We've seen, haven't we, already, as we just quickly gloss over, remind ourselves of some of these things, of the characters that are addressed in the book of Proverbs. You've got the wise, you've got the fool, you've got the scoffer, you've got the simple, you've got the sluggard, the glutton, the adulterer, the seducer, the gullible, the naive, and the drunkard. They are all here, aren't they? Described and laid out for us, describing humanity, the pitfalls of humanity, how do you avoid them and, well, live skillfully and wisely, preparing to die and face God in judgment. The wise listens and obeys God. The fool, he resists God. The scoffer is worse than a fool because he mocks and laughs after knowing the truth for himself. The simple is not committed to either wisdom or folly and is somewhat, well, we find him here this evening, torn between two worlds, if you like. We've seen something of the key themes already. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and that's a repeated theme throughout the book. The limits to human wisdom that without God and without God's revelation, we have no ability whatsoever to talk about the origin, as we began this morning in the book of Genesis, the origin of the universe, the origin of life, the origin of marriage, the origin of the family. We can't even begin to understand the origin of government and culture and the arts and everything else. Science and philosophy and history have no ability to delve into these things whatsoever. And we see the limits of human wisdom. And you can search all of the religious books, and you can search all the philosophies, and you can go to the Greeks, or you can go to the Babylonians, or you can go to the Egyptians, or you can go to Westerners and the Europeans. Over the last 500 years, you can go to the Far East and everywhere else, and you will find very, very quickly the limits of human wisdom. We don't know how we got here. We don't know why we're here. We don't know what we're here for. How on earth can man have meaning, purpose, dignity, as we saw this morning? The book of Proverbs reminds us again and again that without God, we remain in darkness and are somewhat foolish. And it's only the light of God and the light of God that is revealed in scriptures, and particularly the light that is revealed to us in Jesus Christ, that can really give us the wisdom that we need to live righteously, to prepare ourselves for death, judgment, and eternity. The righteous and the wicked in relation to God is a grand theme, isn't it, throughout the book. Grappling with suffering. How do we deal with suffering? How do we cope with suffering? How do we cope with sickness and bereavement and bankruptcy and broken marriages even and all of these things? It's all dealt with, isn't it, in this book of wisdom. We have sinned, haven't we? And in a sense, I prefer what we've already looked at and what we will go back to, the promises of wisdom. That wisdom protects us, that wisdom is valuable, and it points us to live in a certain way. But sometimes we need warnings. We need red lights, don't we? We need stop signs. Not that long ago in Florida, I don't know if many of you have been to America, but they have great big stop signs at all of the interchanges and at all of the corners. Great big stop signs. Well, a group of young lads thought it would be funny to go around the town pulling out the stop signs and hiding them. Well, it wasn't very long until there was utter disaster and multiple people lost their lives. We like the green lights. We like being told what to do. We certainly love to hear the promises of God in the gospel. We certainly love to hear about heaven as we heard about it last week. But we need warnings. We need stop signs. We need God to speak to us like he speaks to us this evening. The Proverbs deal with so many and various subjects, don't they? And it's going to take us quite a while to get through to the end of the book. Setting goals that guide decision making. If you don't know where you're heading towards, it's very unlikely that you're going to get there, isn't it? So you need to set yourself goals. Where are you going? What are you doing with your life? What do you want to accomplish and achieve? It's all there in the book of Proverbs, isn't it? Planning, preparing, consulting with the wise, and getting others to help you and pray with you about decision making. Poverty and riches, money, stewardship, generosity, savings, corruption, bribery. It's all here in the book of Proverbs. Work and leisure, laziness and diligence, especially at harvest time, is dealt with. Business, who to hire and fire, and good worker, it's all here, isn't it? Learning from the mistakes of fools, the tongue, speaking wise and helpful words of truth, rather than speaking evil or tale-bearing or gossip and lying, it is all dealt with, and many other subjects besides. But this evening, we deal with sexual morality or immorality, purity or impurity. We read chapter 5, we read chapter 7, we could have read from chapter 6 and verse 20 to verse 35, and well, it is a subject dealt with most comprehensively, dealt with maybe more, there's more literature given and more time given over to it than any other subject, maybe because it devastated Solomon's family, it devastated Solomon's life, and it potentially is one of the most dangerous of all sins. It's ironic that Solomon is the one that writes to us about it, because he was virtually ruined, wasn't he, by his attraction to many foreign wives. It's a sin that brought great shame, great pain to David's life, family, and the nation. And so Solomon makes sure he writes very comprehensively and clearly on the subject. Again and again, we see at the beginning of these passages, whether it's chapter 5, verses 1 to 6, chapter 6 we didn't read from verse 20, and at the beginning of chapter 7 we're reminded that sexual education is to take place in the home. It's from the lips of a father to his son. It is the duty of parents, isn't it? And not the education system, not the strangers, not media, not anybody else to educate our young on such subjects. We cannot abdicate this responsibility to the entertainment industry, even to the church or to anybody else. The world is full of temptation, destruction, and disaster. So we need these words of warning, and they really need to be from the home first and foremost. Well, as we divide up this evening briefly to 3 points, and we're going to look at the whole lot of everything that we read under 3 points. First one is, Madam Folly will destroy you. Lady Wisdom, though, will save you, and your wife can and should help you. First point then. Chapter 7 particularly, he plays out this play. He's looking, isn't he? Almost reminds us of David looking out from his roof and he's looking down into the street. Well, what did David do? Rather than turning away, rather than being where he should have been with his army at that point, well, Solomon records this little play for us. He looks down, he sees the simple, he sees the young, he sees the naive, he sees the young man who is not well instructed maybe in such things, and then he sees the woman, the seductress, doesn't he, calling him. And well, we see the prey. He's a naive, young, and experienced young man. The scenario, as I said, is a disastrous one. He's the wrong person, in the wrong company, in the wrong place, at the wrong time. And it ends in disaster. We see her tactics, don't we? She attacks his ears in verse 5. That they may keep you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words. In verse 18, come, let us take our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with love. Now, I'm pretty sure we all know what is happening here, what she is inviting him to with her lips. She attacks his ears. She attacks his eyes, doesn't she, in verse 10. And there a woman met him with the attire of a harlot and a crafty heart. So she's all dressed up for the occasion, isn't she? She attacks his ears with sweet words, seductive words. She attacks his eyes. She's dressed for the occasion. She looks very appealing. She attacks his lips and begins to kiss him in verse 13. She attacks his nose, doesn't she? Saying that she's got all these spices and things that would arouse all kinds of emotions and feelings and lusts. She attacks his stomach, saying, look, I've made my peace offerings and all the rest of the meat from the peace offering. Admittedly, you need to know a little bit about the book of Leviticus to really understand it. But nonetheless, she has gone and she has gone to the temple. She seems to be somewhat religious even, church going if you like. But I've got loads of meat left at home to eat. I've got a bed. A nice, comfortable, luxurious bed all laid out for the poor, young, naive, simple man who probably, well, just sleeps on an old rag with a few bits of hay underneath. He thinks he's won the lottery and he's going to have the best night of his life. Her tactics are working. She then attacks all of his doubts and fears in verse 19 and 20. For my husband, because he's thinking, well, what about the husband? What about other family members or whatever? I'm going to get caught, aren't I? And, well, in their day, that kind of a sin was severely punished. But she attacks all of his doubts and fears. For my husband is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. He's taken quite a lot of money with him. He's going to come home only on the appointed day, and that is not tonight or tomorrow. No one's going to find out. More than likely, he won't come back at all. We'll get married soon. God made us like this. It's natural and it's normal. There is nothing wrong with it whatsoever. Everybody else is doing it.
You don't need much of an imagination, do you, this evening to see exactly what is going on.
The language may be from 3,000 years ago, and some of the words maybe are words that we don't really grasp and understand. But I'm sure you can see what is going on, that Madam Folly will destroy you. If you read later on, it talks of the adulteress. Her conscience is seared. She doesn't have a conscience. She can one minute go down to the temple with her sacrifices, the next minute bring the rest of the meat and try and grab a young man on the way home at the same time. We read in verse 11 and 12. She is married, but she's loud and rebellious. Her feet would not stay at home. At times she was outside, at times in the open square, lurking at every corner. She's unwilling to commit to her marriage. She's unwilling to commit herself to the God she proclaims to worship and serve. She's unwilling to commit herself to her home and to her children. This is who she is. This is who the prey is. And these are the tactics that she uses. And well, we see what is the outcome of it all. Disaster. With her enticing speech in verse 21, she caused him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Immediately he went after her as an ox goes to the slaughter, as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till an arrow struck his liver, as a bird hastens to the snare. He did not know it would cost his life. She goes on, doesn't he, in verse 26 and 27, for she has cast down many wounded, and all who were slain by her were strong men. So it's not just the naive, it's not just the young, it's not just the inexperienced, is it? It's those who are in their middle years, maybe, those who are middle-aged, those who are experienced, those who know a few things about life as well. Strong men have been brought down, haven't they? Her house is the way to hell, descending to the chambers of death. We can read over and over again of all the destruction of it all. We could read of Samson, couldn't we? A strong man brought down, not by the Philistine army, but by one woman. We could read about how sin diverts us away from wisdom in chapter 5. But ultimately, as the scriptures tell us again and again and again and again, the soul that sinneth shall die. Sin brings death. We're going to look at it, aren't we, in the book of Genesis. Why is there death? Why do we all die? Why is it between something like 60 and 80 or 90 or so in the Western world and between 40 and 60 or so in Africa and most of it, why do we all die? Is it because God doesn't know how to create us without death in the equation? Is it because God delights in the mourning and the tears and the bereavement and the brokenness and the suffering? No. We were told at the beginning, and we're told again and again and again and again, that sin brings death. It brings spiritual ruin, doesn't it? In the midst of social and financial disgrace, and we can't go around reading all of the verses and bringing all of the details out, but it brings social disgrace. Even in the 21st century, even in the Western world, there is disgrace and shame in this area, let alone in Africa and Asia and in the ancient world. It brought social disgrace and financial ruin. You cannot escape the punishment of God, even if you escape other punishments. Chapter 6 and verse 29 says, so is he who goes into his neighbor's wife, whoever touches her shall not be innocent. Now, I know this is controversial, this is difficult. You go, what on earth are you doing, thinking about things that were written 3,000 years ago? But my friends, maybe the language is from 3,000 years ago, but the ideas, the concepts, the wisdom behind them all are just as true today as they ever have been or ever will be. Now, we are a relatively small church compared to multiple churches in America and in other places. But just think about it. Just open your mind and think about it for a little while. The scandal inside and outside of the church in the history of humanity. The tears that sexual immorality has brought
to literally millions of people in the history of the world. The broken families and all that comes from divorce and separation. The sexually transmitted diseases and the, well, the shame of all of dealing with that. The expensive divorces, the blackmail often of a man who is caught in these things as somebody finds out, whether it's the woman herself or various other family members. The illegitimate children and the difficulties that they face in society so very often. The Bible is portraying to us wisdom, real life. Now, we're not here to say the world is like Hollywood and television and the media. The world is not like Hollywood. It is not like the media. It is not what you find in television. That is not the real world. That's a fake world. That's just a masquerade. That's just a lie and a deception. Sexual immorality will destroy you. It is destroyed thousands already. And we're going to hear at the end of this evening, we're going to hear about the grace of God, the mercy of God, the kindness of God, the goodness of God, the patience of God. But if that is the kind of life that you live in sexual immorality, Madam Folly will destroy you. Now there are greater dangers in our day and in our age, admittedly. Alcohol was relatively expensive and hard to get hold of, particularly for the young in that time. Drugs were virtually non-existent at that time. Gambling was, well, not really a problem amongst the Israelite people. It was difficult to engage in. The internet obviously didn't exist back then. So this was one of the ways, if you like, that sin got hold of young people and destroyed people's lives. The warning is there for us. The warning is there for us. If we are addicted to watching things on the internet, if we are engaged in sexual immorality, whether we're married or unmarried, Madam Folly will destroy you. Second heading, and a bit better news for us this evening, is that Lady Wisdom will save you. That's what the book is all about, again and again and again. It portrays wisdom as personified. Wisdom isn't just some ideas that some old people have that hand on to the next generation. But wisdom is personified, isn't it? As God is eternal and infinite wisdom. And as we'll see in chapter 8, Christ himself is the wisdom of God in Paul's language. Lady Wisdom will save you. It's not all doom and gloom and inevitable backsliding, struggling, failure, death and destruction, although the warning is as clear as it could ever be for us this evening. The Lord is here to help and empower and strengthen us. Put those stop signs in place when we need them to deliver and help us. We have a warning as well as a promise, don't we? In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed. Me, maybe. And everybody else who is a mature and a godly Christian here this evening, the warning is, isn't it? Therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. For no temptation has overtaken you but such which is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape. And we see here again and again that if we listen, if we heed wisdom, if we embrace wisdom, if you like, if we value wisdom, as we've been told again and again in the book of Proverbs, it will deliver us, it will save us, it will help us, it will guide us, it will bless us. Now, I'm not going to ask anybody here this evening to do that. We're English, so we don't have much of a congregation participation. But in Africa or in Asia, we could do it. And you would get more than a couple of people from here this evening stand up saying, yes, amen, you are right. How many of us here this evening have grown up in a Christian home, have been taught these things by our father and our mother, have remained sexually pure until marriage, we've waited and prayed. The person whom we've married has had something of the approval of our godly parents. We have entered into marriage sexually pure, and it is a great blessing to us. If we were in Africa, a few men would stand up right now and say, amen. That is true. It is right. It is different to the world. It is contrary to the world. But the Bible has always been calling us to live contrary to the world. And the way to heaven is a narrow and a difficult path. But God is here to help us and to give us the wisdom and the strength and the self-control and all the help that we need. Now we're going to see as we close briefly that a righteous man may fall seven times. We get caught up in stuff. We're not talking about somebody who commits adultery or fornicates on one occasion. We're not talking about somebody who just watches the internet on a couple of occasions. We have here a young man who is brought into a lifestyle that is a habitual characteristic of who he becomes. And he would rather the sin and the folly and the foolishness of it all, and it leads to destruction. But the other side of it is that wisdom will save you. Wisdom reveals the true nature of the seductress, the true nature of temptation, the true nature of sin and the consequences of it. And if we embrace Lady Wisdom, as we've sinned again and again, it's the most valuable thing. If we were to say, who would like the winning lottery ticket, I'm sure we'd all say, yes, please. If we were to say, who would like any car that you could possibly choose from, I'm sure a lot of us, particularly the young men, would say, I'll have such and such a car. If we could say, who would like to live healthy till they're 100 years old? I'm sure a number of us would say, yes, please. But what God is telling us through the book of Proverbs again and again and again is, do you want peace? Do you want joy? Do you want wisdom? Do you want the blessing of God? Do you want to be saved from all the disasters that people find themselves in? Do you want to be escorted away from the seductress, escorted away from sexually transmitted diseases? Do you want to be escorted away from disastrous relationships your whole life? Would you like it God's way, where you stay sexually pure until you marry and you have a good marriage where you can enjoy those things with the blessing of God upon them? Surely, we would say, yes, Madam Folly, the world will destroy me, but Lady Wisdom can save me. In a sense, the passage is saying to us that we're all going to embrace one or the other. One will destroy, but the other will deliver. The other will save. The other will bless you. Madam Folly will destroy you. Lady Wisdom will save you if you would embrace her. And our final point, your wife can and should help you. We read in chapter 5, didn't we? Drink water from your own cistern and running water from your own well. Should your fountains be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be only your own and let not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth as a loving deer and a graceful doe. Let her breast satisfy you at all times and always be enraptured with her love. For why should you, my son, be enraptured by an immoral woman and be embraced in the arms of a seductress? Sex isn't a sinful thing at all, is it? It's poetic language, isn't it? Not all sexual activity at all is sordid or dirty or inherently evil at all. We're going to see, aren't we, as we move from chapters 1 into 2 and 3 of the book of Genesis, that God has created us male and female. He kept saying throughout these chapters, I know we're getting ahead of ourselves from Genesis, but it was good, it was good, it was good, it was good. And then he says, it's not good for Adam to be on his own. He creates Eve, he brings them together, and then God says, once again, not it is good, but it is very good. And he says to them, go forth, be fruitful and multiply. The whole concept of Christian monasticism or Catholic celibacy or total abstinence is totally unbiblical. Husbands and wives have a responsibility and a duty towards one another. You can read it in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 that when we marry, we give ourselves to our partner. We have responsibilities to sexually satisfy our partner. Marriage and home and the family are the design, the gift, the blessing of God, and are honorable, Hebrews tells us, in God's sight. God has been so pleased to create us male and female. There are some creatures that are asexual and can reproduce in and of themselves and don't have the great joy of sexual activity. But not us. God is the God of love, we are told. God is a God who loves and embraces his Son and the Spirit and the Son, the Father. And there is an intricate, not an erotic, not a sexual love between them, but a divine and an infinite and an eternal love between them. And God says, I want you as my creatures to enjoy love. I want you to experience all of the very various facets of love. And I am going to create you male and female. To reflect the gospel, to reflect the love of Christ for his bride, the church, to reflect something of the eternal love of God that exists between Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and so that your lives can be something of a witness to the unbelieving world. It's not always easy. And the Bible tells us, on one side of the coin, he who finds a wife finds a good thing and receives favor from the Lord. And on the other side, that you will have difficulties and trials. You put two sinners and make them one, living in the same house, in the same room, sleeping in the same bed with young children, there's going to be difficulties and trials. But the majority of it is to be blessing and joy and peace and love. And the great joy, as we read here, of sexual satisfaction. Your wife can and should help you. Madam Folly will destroy you. Lady Wisdom, if you embrace her, will save and deliver and bless and guide and help you. And your wife should and can help you in this area. Now there's going to be lots of questions. Well, what about this and what about that? Well, we've dealt with an introduction to the subject, if you like, and later on the subject is revisited and some of the details are dealt with later on. But as we close this evening, we're reminded, aren't we, in chapter 5 and 21, for the ways of man are before the eyes of the Lord and he ponders all his paths. Now, we couldn't imagine 200 years ago the age of information and technology in which we live in. We couldn't imagine Big Brother 200 years ago. We couldn't imagine all of the cameras that are everywhere, the vast amounts of information that is at our fingertips on the internet. We couldn't imagine that there could be that many eyes watching in that many places. And we're so often like Moses, aren't we? Before he killed the Egyptian, it says he looked to the left and he looked to the right, he looked in front and he looked behind, and he killed the Egyptian. He failed, as often we do, to look up. But God is looking down. God sees all things. We heard this morning, didn't we, that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. That he is before the beginning, he is timeless and eternal, he is self-existent. He creates time, he creates space, he creates matter and every single other proton and electron and atom that there is in the entire universe. If God can say, let there be light, and creates all things, it's not too difficult to add to the equation of who God is that he sees and knows all. He knows our thoughts, he knows our desires, he knows our motives. And he looks to bless, and he looks because he will judge and punish on the day of judgment. And so we need to flee and we need to run metaphorically like Joseph. When Joseph was embraced by Potiphar's wife and Potiphar's wife said, lie with me. There's nobody else around. Nobody else will see. I'm going to get rid of him later. And all of the other excuses and everything else that we see here, what does he do? He wriggles out of his clothing and he runs for his life. Flee youthful lusts, but pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace with those who call on the Lord. When Jesus deals with the subject, he tells us, doesn't he, that even the look, the second look, the look of lust, if you like, is adultery in the heart and needs to be dealt with radically. And he says, if your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. Now, not literally, but metaphorically. We flee, we run for our lives. We need to listen again and again. The passage is calling us, isn't it, to listen, to take heed. Not to the internet, not to the media, not to the education system, not to this, that, and everybody else. The voices are crying out, crying out. Everybody's doing it. You won't get caught. It's normal. You won't get sexually transmitted diseases. You won't have an unwanted pregnancy. You won't ruin people's lives emotionally. The world is calling us to think in an unbiblical way, isn't it? But the Bible is calling us to listen, to take heed. God sees all things. And sometimes you're just going to need to flee and run from temptation and sin. We've already been told, and we're told here again, that we need to keep the heart diligently, don't we? The seventh commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery, isn't just condemning those who are married having sex outside of marriage, but Jesus' interpretation, isn't it, that we need to keep the heart pure, the eyes pure, the hands pure. And that we've got to keep the heart with all diligence. Again and again, he talks about the heart here in chapter 6 and verse 25. Do not lust after her beauty in your heart, nor let her allure you with her eyelids. Or chapter 7 and verse 3. Bind them on your fingers, write them on the tablet of your heart. Or chapter 7 and verse 25. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her. But again and again, it's a heart issue, isn't it? It begins in the heart. Until the actual sin is committed and then repeatedly committed and then habitually committed until it becomes a part of your life, it begins in the heart. And so as chapter 4 says, keep the heart with all diligence, for from it flow the issues of life. Now this is predominantly for those up in the balcony. Maybe some up in the balcony, not so much, but nonetheless. What does this mean to all of us here this evening? Maybe you're getting older and you're not so sexually active and you've got a good marriage and this, that, and everything else. What do you take out of this evening? You pray, don't you, for the young people? I hate to say it. I feel middle-aged to say it. I feel like my dad when I'm saying it. But the world isn't like what it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago. It isn't. They have to endure temptations. They have to endure a society that we well wouldn't think possible 20, 30 years ago. I hate to find myself saying it, but nonetheless, that's the truth of it. For most of us, many of us here this evening, our response will be to go away and to thank God for our husbands and our wives and to pray for our children and the young people in our churches. It reminds us fathers that we need to lovingly yet faithfully instruct and protect our teenagers and our unmarried children. We need to build relationships with them and encourage accountability. The last thing I take from this evening, although it is a stop sign, and we love the green lights and we love the promises and we love to hear about salvation and forgiveness and mercy and grace and heaven and eternal life and Christ has done everything and all that the gospel is and the resurrection of Christ and Christmas and all that is. We love to hear about this. So positive. We've had a stop sign. We've had a warning. we need to hear, but we must close on a note of grace. That if there is anybody here who is caught up in things that we have pinpointed and challenged together this evening, if there is anybody here this evening who has been tempted into sexual immorality and impurity in whatever form it may be, there is grace. There is mercy and forgiveness. And the challenge for us this evening is to respond, isn't it? For some of us, it will be, God, protect these young people amongst us. For others, it will be, God, protect my children. For others, it will be, God, help me not to fall into such a sin. You can say, well, I'm not young, but we're reminded that David, it wasn't while he was a youngster, but while he was a middle-aged man, he fell into this sin. God, help me. God, help us not to fall into such things. We can also say, thank you, Lord, that though I've taken a second and a third look and committed adultery in my heart, though I have maybe looked at things on the internet that I shouldn't have looked at, though I have maybe fornicated before I was married or even committed adultery after marriage, there is grace, mercy, forgiveness. We all have something to say to God together this evening. Amen. Well.